Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Be Here for a While. Today's episode of Be Here for a While is brought to you by Best Fiends. How you guys doing? It's another day in quarantine. I mean, things are opening up a little bit, though. We got to dine outdoors yesterday. That was pretty cool. And I'm dining outdoors with my engagement ring on, and I want to brag. I'm a different person. It's just, I feel fancy now. I check on my ring sometimes in the middle of the night when I'm not wearing it, just to make sure it's still okay. Sometimes I talk to it. Oh, also, Greg's pretty cool, too. I'm joking. Okay, guys. So today, the episode is not going to be an interview. I have been working my butt off on my other podcast, Seven Deadly Sinners. And if you guys have not checked it out, well, today I'm going to give you a sneak peek of one of the episodes. I chose one that wasn't super dark, that was in case you're not into true crime. So one that's like a little lighter, easier to digest, and it's just absolutely bonkers. I mean, my mind kept being blown with every new, it's almost like it was hitting new levels of just insanity, this case, that I don't want to give it away. You'll hear. So, so today's episode is about the cult of Synanon. And yeah, so without further ado, here's me talking.
He was a preacher who couldn't resist temptation.
The priest is accused of killing Sister Margaret Ann Paul in the chapel.
The strongest of cases against a powerful preacher in a town of true believers.
The legal age for marriage is at puberty. I'm not married to any teenage girls who don't want to be. I'm 74 years old.
I don't remember reading that in the Bible, sir.
You don't know anything about the Bible.
And he kept stabbing and smiling.
410 wounds, scars upon scars.
You're listening to Seven Deadly Sinners.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you all so much for listening and also connecting with us on Instagram at Seven Deadly Sinners Podcast. I seriously love hearing from you guys, and I love hearing your personal stories. So much so that I set up an email if you want to share them. It's sevendeadlysinnerspodcast@gmail.com. And I'm thinking it might be cool to do a bonus episode where I read your personal stories of encounters you've had with false prophets, scam artists, cults even. Listen, all of the above. Anything you guys have sent me in is definitely story worthy. Additionally, if you want to share your story but be left anonymous, I can leave your name out of it. So yeah. And I just thought it would be fun to connect with you all further, so send them in if you have them. Okay, so I know I might say this with a lot of cases, but my mind is truly blown by how far-reaching and vicious this case is. What I started to research has evolved into something so much bigger. So with that being said, this will be another multi-part series. I'm going to try to keep it to three parts, but it may be four, because once you hear about all the insane happenings of how much influence the subject had, you'll know why it needs the airtime. Honestly, when I thought it couldn't get any more strange and frankly very scary, the story just kept upping its own ante. And now, I'm here for the whole wild ride, and I hope you are too. So, today's sin is pride. Pride is considered to be the most dangerous of the seven deadly sins. The prideful person may overestimate their own abilities and may refuse to acknowledge their own faults. They believe they are the smartest person in any room. They are the superior authority. In many cases, they wouldn't be caught dead giving you credit or praise for any of your positive attributes and accomplishments. A pride-obsessed person is also dangerously corrupt in their selfishness and their need to be adored and admired. A prideful person is so committed to their furthering of their ideology in pursuit of influence, success, and control that they are, unsurprisingly, the prime candidate to become a cult leader. And in our case today, Charles Dietrich and his cult that masqueraded as a not-for-profit rehab was so lucrative and dangerous that it went on to inspire an entire industry of facilities that are responsible for hundreds of missing people and thousands upon thousands of damaged souls. And they are still operating today.
Synanon is a real corporation. Its business is junkies.
Mind control.
The organization is composed of what Synanon calls dope fiends, squares, and delinquent children, punks.
No, just another dope fiend.
The organization has become a self-contained cradle-to-grave society with $33 million in assets. Synanon owns airplanes and boats. In 1970, smoking was forbidden. Male members had vasectomies. Pregnant women had abortions.
Chuck Dietrich is the ex-drunk who dreamed it up and fights to keep it from becoming a nightmare.
My first impressions were very bad of Chuck. I resented him, and I think I hated him.
And to say to him, throw all of your normal law-abiding concepts out of the window. Here's a chance to raise merry hell. It was in this atmosphere that the search for mind control began.
I'm quite convinced that he actually knows more about me than I know about myself.
And then, like, it all turned around, and everything I saw, I hated. I just hated Chuck Dietrich.
100 million doses of LSD, administration of sodium pentothal, hypnosis, isolation, and deprivation of sleep. Search for mind control.
But before we get to how Charles, also known as Chuck Dietrich, created what has been called one of the most dangerous and violent cults in American history, let's hear about its very humble and troubled beginnings. Charles Dietrich was born on March 22, 1913, in Toledo, Ohio, to his parents Agnes and Charles Dietrich. His mother was a singer and his father was a promoter. And we will come to find out that Charles shared more than just the same name as his father. He also shared his penchant for booze. Chuck's father suffered from alcoholism and died in a car crash when Chuck was just 4 years old. For the rest of the story, I will be referring to him by his nickname, Chuck. Unsurprisingly, a combination of genetics coupled with the childhood trauma of losing his dad at 4 and then also at 8 years old losing his brother to a terrible case of influenza, Chuck turned to alcohol to self-medicate. Now, before I get too much further into this story, and I will be making jokes at Chuck's expense because he is a really, really shitty person who ruined a ton of lives, I just want to say that I have many close friends who have struggled with addiction. I think it is a very human thing. We all, in some way or another, find ways to cope with the hard realities and hard times that come up in life. And I also don't feel that I or anyone else is above or immune to falling into an addiction in some form or another. This can even be shopping, exercise, sex, obviously drugs and alcohol to cope. So with that being said, I feel for these people so much. Additionally, the addiction and mental health field are still in the research process of finding out exactly what causes it and what are the best ways to help people that are struggling. Regardless, what Chuck did to these people can almost universally be viewed as quite the opposite of help. It was incredibly harmful and truly became something so far from what its origins were. So after losing his father and brother at a young age, Chuck began drinking heavily in high school. His drinking continued into his college years, where he dropped out of Notre Dame University due to his failing grades as a result of his alcohol abuse. By 1944, now in his early 30s, he got work as a traveling salesman for Gulf Oil, where he met his first wife, Chilnessa McKeon, and had a son. Chuck then came down with meningitis that left him in a 2-week coma. He survived, but the effects from the illness were lasting. He was left with partial deafness, and part of his face was left paralyzed, which resulted in a permanent sneer. And he acquired a new dependency on the drug Benzedrine. Benzedrine was the first brand of amphetamines marketed in the United States in the 1930s. Doctors prescribed it for conditions ranging from depression to narcolepsy, and it may have also given Chuck the speed-induced overconfidence that would mark many of his future endeavors. After his recovery from meningitis, Chuck moved his family to Los Angeles, and not long after, his first wife divorced him due to his increasing alcohol abuse. He next married his second wife, Ruth Jason, and they had a daughter. After another rocky marriage, on the verge of divorce, his second wife encouraged him to enter AA. AA did not save their marriage, but it did get him sober. It was 1956. Chuck was now 43 years old, surviving on $33 a month in unemployment checks and living in Santa Monica, California. While in AA, Chuck enjoyed having a captive audience when he spoke. He had a knack for public speaking. He was charismatic and domineering. And whether or not everyone else enjoyed hearing him speak, he sure loved the sound of his own voice. Chuck was once quoted as saying, quote, "I say this with as much humility as I am capable, which isn't very much. When I sit down and I start to talk, people start gathering. It just happens. I can't stop it." Chuck then participated in an experimental treatment at UC Berkeley that was giving LSD to people struggling with alcoholism. Chuck would say in an interview later that the LSD experiment was one of the most significant and important moments of his life. He also began studying the ideas of Ralph Waldo Emerson and the concept of self-reliance, which advocates for people to avoid conformity, focus on their individualism, and to nurture one's own self-confidence and to avoid the community of organized groups or religion. Ironic, considering what happens next. Chuck decided that there were some things he didn't like about AA. He didn't like their soft, supportive approach, and he also didn't like that they didn't accept drug addicts. So, with no formal training, no psychology background, and not even that much sober time under his belt, Chuck set out to form his own rehabilitation group based on his own ideas. In 1958, around 11 regulars began gathering in his rundown apartment to participate in Chuck's therapy, where the members would call out other members for behaviors they considered egotistical. It quickly evolved into members viciously, verbally attacking each other. It wasn't a back and forth, though. No, if you were in the hot seat, you were basically pummeled with all the worst things the other members thought of you until it was the next person's turn. And insanely, Chuck called this first iteration of the group the Tender, Loving Care Club. The group grew. People caught wind of the new age approach to rehab, and they were encouraged by a rumor that a member was able to kick heroin within the group. Now, about 20 members were regularly attending, so Chuck had to expand. He rented a run-down storefront in a seedy area of Santa Monica for the meetings to take place. At one of these meetings, a member of the group reportedly slurred the word seminar, which Chuck heard as the person saying, Synanon. And just like that, they had a new name for the group, Synanon. Now, there's another theory of how the name formed, with the first three letters S-Y-N meaning togetherness and anon meaning the unknown. But I like the first story better, so that's what I'm going with. Chuck then incorporated Synanon and made it a legit business. This is Synanon 1, the drug rehab years, from around 1958 to 1966. The verbal attack sessions got their own name as well. They began to call it the game, and the attacks got even more belittling and damaging because now the allegations hurled at the members didn't even need to be true. And vulgarity was encouraged. It was, quote, "Talk dirty and live clean," said Chuck. And so the other members would accuse the defendant of real and imagined crimes, of being selfish, unthinking, of being a no-good, ugly, diseased cocksucker who was too weak to go straight and was too much of an asshole, junkie, crybaby motherfucker to admit it. Faced with this unrelenting group assault, The recipient would eventually have little choice but to admit their wrongdoing and promise to mend their ways. Then the group would turn to the next person and begin all over again. Around this time, Chuck met his third wife, Betty Coleman, who was a self-described former prostitute and junkie. In an article in LA Mag, Betty was quoted as saying, "I think I stayed those first two or three days just out of total fascination." That was her first encounter with Synanon in 1959. She said, quote, "I was sick as a dog. I was going through the usual withdrawal symptoms and everything, but I was just fascinated. I had never been around addicts and such a strange, motley lot, you know, of people. It was a weird scene. I got caught up in it." Coleman would relapse a number of times, but she always returned, eventually marrying Chuck. To be fair, Betty isn't the only person who claims to have had a helpful experience at Synanon in its early days. I think when you're so desperate for a change and to get away from the hard life of chasing a high, maybe it was what they needed. Okay, I'll admit it. I got into crystals for a little bit, all right? And I used to keep a crystal with me all the time for good luck and just a little burst of, you know, security, I guess. But these days, I keep my favorite game with me all the time. I'm talking about Best Fiends, the top-rated mobile puzzle adventure game. Best Fiends has thousands of levels plus new content added all the time, so you never run out of entertainment. You're not going to get bored. Boredom doesn't stand a chance with Best Fiends. And you don't have to be a hardcore gamer to love this casual game. It's made for adults, but fun for all, unless you hate fun. In that case, it's probably not for you. But I have a feeling, if you're anything like me, you like fun. If you're listening to this podcast, you're a fun gal or guy. Seriously, my favorite thing about the game is it helps me to de-stress, but also keeps my mind active. Like, I have a hard time just chilling. So it's a way for me to chill, but also stay active. And I swear I get like a rush of adrenaline when I beat a new level. It's so fun. I feel so satisfied. And sometimes it takes me a while to do it, but that makes it even more satisfying when I do. And there's literally thousands of levels to play. There's new content added today, tomorrow, and the day after that. You're never going to run out. Plus, there's tons of cute characters to collect. So, if you never get tired of solving puzzles, good news. With Best Fiends, the fun never ends. Just don't blame me if you become slightly obsessed, okay? So, download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R, Best Fiends. In the second year of its inception, Synanon grew to 50 members, and now, as part of the therapeutic program, the members were required to get jobs and to turn over their entire paychecks to Chuck and Synanon. Initially, Chuck decided that the rehab process would take 2 years, and members were required to stay until Chuck graduated them. With the new funds coming in, they upgraded to a larger facility. First, to a vacant National Guard building, and eventually into a gorgeous brick building right on the beach in Santa Monica that is now a luxury hotel called Casa del Mar, which goes for over $500 per night. When they moved into the beachfront property in Santa Monica, it caused an issue with the neighbors, though, as they didn't want to share their community with so-called dope fiends, and they reported Synanon to the authorities. Chuck was arrested as it was discovered that he was operating Synanon without any license or experience. Instead of vacating the property and giving up his group, as was required to receive bail, he opted to spend 30 days in jail. This caught the attention of the media, and major newspapers like the LA Times wrote articles about it. Chuck was seen as this sort of renegade martyr who was super devoted to helping people. When he was released from jail, he was told that he couldn't operate as a residential rehab anymore due to zoning laws. However, Synanon supporters pushed the government to exempt Synanon from health licensing laws, and the current California governor accepted, and in 1961 signed a bill granting Chuck the right to continue under the condition that the state medical board would oversee Synanon's activities and create regulations. The relationship would end up being strained as Chuck arrogantly rejected almost every regulation and advice given to him by the trained medical professionals. Eventually, the board gave up and they backed away, and Chuck was left to operate and control with no formal training and no watchdog for decades. He also began to publicly spin his operations as a private nonprofit self-improvement club. He was still treating addicts, but the self-improvement approach opened it up to tons of new members. New, very rich members. Plus, he was also actually horrible at treating addicts. Only 10% of addicts stayed clean. Now, I'm not a drug person, but if a group of people screamed in my face for hours on end, I'd probably want a little buffer from the abuse, and it might be nice to pop a few lewds to get through the verbal boxing match. I don't actually really know what lewds are, I just like saying them. I mean, my only reference for them is when they say Quaaludes in Almost Famous, so lewds. Now he moved Synanon to its next phase, Synanon 2, a utopian society, which operated from around 1967 to 1973. Hollywood even took notice, and actors like Jane Fonda and Leonard Nimoy even attended some meetings. There were still many hardcore members that literally lived at the large Casa del Mar facility, but they were allowing outsiders to join in on the spiritual cleansing sessions held nightly at the swanky establishment. The Jane Fondas of the world could saunter in, play the game once and maybe twice, and dance to the sounds of the house jazz band, and then go home without ever seeing what was really going on behind the scenes. Yes, now they had a house band, like they were the Tonight Show. Chuck was really moving up. Hollywood also came knocking and produced a movie about the cult called Synanon, 1965, starring Edmund O'Brien as Chuck and Eartha Kitt as his wife, Betty. Extremely wealthy people began to donate crazy sums of money to the group. One woman gave them $1 million. One man gave his mortgage company to Synanon valued at $900,000, and another donated his extremely lucrative advertising company, which will play a huge role in Synanon's growth. And several others sold their homes and gave the profits to Chuck. But hey, do you blame them? Who needs a home when Chuck has a new plan? He was developing a compound he was calling Synanon City. You don't need your pesky home when Chuck is here to decide where you'll live, what you'll eat, how you'll be verbally castrated. Oh, and one other thing. Chuck was no longer graduating the members. They were now required to stay for life. They were still expected to work and turn over their paychecks to Chuck, but he realized that if he graduated them and told them they were healthy individuals, they would leave and stop funding his scam. ADGAP was the name of the advertising business donated to Synanon. ADGAP was an ad business which would make and distribute novelty gifts and promotional items like pens with company logos for General Motors and monogram handbags for the airlines. So basically now Synanon was in the merch business, and they were generating around $10 million a year from a company Chuck did not work to grow. By the end of 1967, Synanon owned millions of dollars in real estate all over the country, including $5 million worth of real estate in Santa Monica alone. So now, it's just 100% about money. Chuck's original goal, if you can call it that, is falling by the wayside. They now had thousands of members. The members who stayed and were not drug addicts were referred to as squares. And unsurprisingly, Chuck gets even more egotistical at this time. And this is where it's about to get so strange that I had to spend at least 3 extra days on the research just to wrap my head around the insanity that ensues. It's time for the reclusive compound to make its way into the age-old cult tale. Chuck bought a ton of acreage in Tamales Bay in Northern California and started to build his Synanon City. Between his compounds and the Santa Monica property, Chuck eventually owned and operated 5,500 acres for Synanon activities. The Tamales Bay location in Marin County was plan to have housing, medical facilities, a school, etc., so members could raise their families, all parts of a functioning society. This expansion was what led to the new name of the cult, Synanon II. Not the most original, but what Chuck lacks in name creativity, he makes up for in how he creatively screws with people's lives. Members flocked to the Tamales Bay compound. Synanon had thousands of members and other branches were popping up around the country. And this is when Chuck decided that he didn't want to deal with the old ball and chain that he first based this cult around, the drug addicts. He felt they whined and complained too much, and he was on to bigger and better things. He didn't directly kick them out, but he upped the ante on the game. He started holding marathon game sessions, where the verbal boxing matches were now lasting days at a time. When some of the old members finally got rest, they were able to reflect and see, yeah, no, this is fucked up, I'm in a cult. But many more members would come and stay until the bitter, violent end. So these marathon game sessions also worked in the opposite way. While it was turning older members off, it was actually breaking new members in. The sleep-deprived, emotional murder of one's self-esteem actually worked to indoctrinate new members. The lasting psychological effect of having your faults and past mistakes thrown in your face made people believe they couldn't function on the outside world. They needed Synanon to survive.
I think that any organization like Synanon, which convinces people that live there that it is such a superior way to live, that causes people to do anything that the organization wants them to do.
I found an environment that was a loving environment. I found a place that was humane, and I found a place that was very firm. All of the things that I needed to change my behavior.
We have then a person that is looking for boundaries. He then is looking for someone to tell him what to do, isn't
it? Please let me first and always examine myself. Let me be honest and truthful. Let me seek and assume responsibility. Let me understand rather than be understood. Let me trust and have faith in myself and my fellow man. Let me love rather than be loved.
What kind of business,
Let
Johnny?
Let me give rather than receive.
Then one day, a friend of your husband's is a client of yours.
No, I didn't, okay? I didn't.
Authority. Take
Johnny,
it easy.
Not. How do I like?
I didn't break the window. I didn't have to say... Tony, please take it easy.
Imagine having that screamed at you for 36 hours at a time. In a new bizarre development, Chuck also started exclusively wearing denim overalls, which didn't really compliment him. He basically went from angry substitute PE teacher drinking gin from a coffee thermos to a bitter overall-wearing gravedigger who drinks gin straight from the bottle. Seriously, Google him. He's angry. The tread spread until the attire was basically mandatory. But it didn't stop there, because if Chuck can't have something, no one can. After his doctor told him that he needed to quit smoking, everyone was required to quit smoking. And they even had to deny a large supply of cigarettes that was being donated to them by a tobacco company. So now you have addicts and others addicted to smoking who were dependent on nicotine, now going through withdrawal and playing the game, screaming in each other's faces. The heightened stress of yelling and the withdrawal set the stage for the head shaving experiment. During a withdrawal session of the game, one member challenged the other to shave their head, and they did. The other member fired back, and then they shaved their head. Chuck loved that this made his followers fall into a shame spiral, masquerading as a vigilante choice, an FU toward the middle class agenda. But the head shaving would quickly change from brainwashed personal choice into a new form of punishment and public humiliation that Chuck implemented into his control arsenal. If a member displeased Chuck, he or another member would demand that they shaved their head. Soon, Chuck had thousands of bald-headed followers, victims of one man's narcissism. It was quite the spectacle. I would imagine how odd it would be to live in the Marin County area and drive by the compound or see them out and about and be thinking, oh no, something is not right here. Well, another Hollywood figure would catch wind, and in one of George Lucas's first projects right out of college, he hired the bald-headed members to be extras in a utopian movie he called THX-1138. By this point, Chuck realized that he needed to get rid of more extra baggage, as they weren't the main moneymakers anymore. Remember, he had a thriving advertising company pulling in millions. And Chuck was living high on the hog with all of the money coming in, but his members were living on $5 a week. It's now the early 70s, and 2,000 members were divided up and living on two massive compounds in the Northern California area. In 1971, he decided to move all Synanon children to one location on their Marin County land away from their parents. It was positioned as a rejection of the nuclear family in favor of a supportive community environment for children to grow up in. It was also pitched as an act of feminism, freeing up women's time from the traditional gender roles, which coincidentally freed up their time to contribute hours and hours of labor toward building the Synanon Empire. Chuck then created a radio station, a loudspeaker-type show that he would pump his thoughts and ideas into the followers' heads. It was called The Wire, and you would have access 24/7 to Chuck's voice. A greater financial benefit arrived in 1974, when Chuck declared that Synanon was now a religion. The new religious status granted by the federal government was a tax advantage, sure, but it also eliminated any future pesky questions like, do you have a license to give therapeutic treatment? Why do your followers have to obey everything you say? And why are they all wearing overalls and have their heads shaved? When do your members graduate? Well, that's no matter now, because nobody actually graduates from a religion. So now it was time for Synanon 3, the Church of Synanon. Chuck went from 43-year-old drunk turned rehab expert, then self-help guru, and now religious leader. He started declaring religious prophecies that contradicted many of his ideas during Synanon's inception. But one thing he was still holding strong to is, if he can't do it, no one can. When his doctor told him that he needed to lose weight, and he was a pretty large, unhealthy man, he told all of the followers that they needed to exercise on demand. He began ordering them to jog in place, and he called this new program the Fat-a-thon. Chuck's arrogance was through the roof at this point. He was regularly making bold and increasingly reckless decisions. While giving a speech at a graduation ceremony, Chuck dropped his pants, exposing himself to the crowd, and said that he was revealing the last mystery of Synanon. Dropped his pants to a crowd of graduation students and families and said, "This is the last mystery of Synanon." What? It's inspiring, guys. What's your problem? Open your mind, you know? Then, as any good religion does, Chuck decided that everyone should get a Harley. Sorry, I can't sit in the street face. Listen, no one ever said that Hell's Angels wasn't also following the Holy Spirit on their long highway rides. It's even in their name. Why can't Synanon have their followers, most who have never, ever ridden a motorcycle, hop on them and ride, man? So Chuck got himself a big Harley, and he got his advisors similar but slightly smaller Harleys, and then he got the general members some form of lower-end motorcycle, but they were required to pay him back. It was Chuck's warped version of Oprah, like, you get a Harley, you get a Harley, you get a Harley, Well, I don't like you as much, so you have to pay me back. It turns out, shockingly, that this was a bad idea. He forced people to ride motorcycles with no experience, and unsurprisingly, members lost limbs, and some even died. At this point, not only was Synanon able to afford motorcycles, well, on loan for the lowly members, they were also pulling in so much money they had multiple airplanes and airstrip, fleets of cars, and much more. Then, in the summer of 1973, an incident would occur that would profoundly change the Synanon community forever. Diedrich himself was taking part in a game, but when one female member was finally standing up to his tyrannical ass and spitting the game at him, infuriated, Diedrich stood up, walked over to the woman, and poured a can of root beer over her head. It was a small gesture of frustration, but the effect within Synanon was earth-shattering. No matter the other changes that had taken place, the rules of the game had always been no drugs and no violence, and now Chuck himself had broken one of them. Some wondered if he'd gone crazy, but his more devoted followers preferred to see it as a sign, as a call to arms. And the relations with locals outside the community would be an example of the unraveling of the cult members. They felt violence was part of what Chuck wanted. After all, he had gone on the Synanon Wire radio station and announced that he was forming an aggressive, militant religious group within Synanon, and they were to be called the Imperial Marines. And Chuck watched with glee as they participated in a special form of karate they had named Synanodu. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Synanodu. But the Imperial Marines were only the tip of the iceberg. When you saw Synanon's residents standing in line in overalls with their bald heads, you saw less a utopian community and more an angry militia. The comparison was made even stronger when it was revealed that Synanon had bought over $300,000 worth of guns and ammunition. They began attacking outsiders in the community for sometimes no reason at all. If you cut them off on the road, they would run your car off and in one incident, rip the person out of the car and beat them. In another and completely horrific scene, two local residents were flying a model plane near Synanon land. They were told they were allowed to do this, but they ended up packing it in early that evening due to the wind going the wrong way. As they were leaving, their car got stuck in the mud at the top of the hill, and after trying for 30 minutes to get it out, they began honking their horn and flashing their lights at passersby to help. What passed by were Synanites, who thought for some reason they were the bounty hunters. They did, after all, have bounty hunters after them and maybe just pin these innocent guys as them. When a local neighbor also came by to verify that the car was stuck, the Synanites that had passed by them must have alerted others. And in Paul Morantz's blog, which we will hear a ton from this brave lawyer later, who was all but murdered by Synanon, he writes this in his blog. I'm also taking the names out of the people involved, as I haven't mentioned their specific names before and it will become too confusing. The two model plane flyers finally headed towards the roadway to flag down help, and they were met with a local who showed up to verify their car was stuck. As he did, about 10 Synanon residents had gathered. As the local left, the number of Synanon members present seemed to multiply, like a scene out of Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. Only these birds were bald, dressed in overalls and carrying clubs and axe handles. One had a tire iron taken from a Jeep. The model plane flyers were told to shut up by the arriving mob. Then they were taken by force into a paneled van and driven to Synanon. While they were transported, a waiting Synanite told Chuck, I think we ought to break a few legs, and then we will have our lawsuits and everyone will learn their lesson, maybe. Chuck replied, maybe they would have resisted, but you don't have to break them, you know, any legs if you got 10 guys handling one guy. Now you can bruise them up a little bit if you're angry at them. I want to capture these guys. Then Chuck said afterwards they could call the sheriff, which was in Synanon's back pocket, and say these guys were exposing themselves in front of our children, so they had to take action. At that point, the two model plane flyers were brought into a temple on Sinanon grounds. Three guys grabbed an arm of each as they were pinned against the wall and searched. Their pocket contents thrown on the floor, voices amongst the Sinanon crowd shouted and mimicked, "Break their fucking legs!" Chuck asked which one was on parole. Then, a Sinanite realized these were not the bounty hunters. Chuck continued on anyway, saying they were in trouble if they fuck around. They were directed to sit on the floor. A Sinanite then said they were in trouble and better recognize it before you get hurt. Now, they know to stay the fuck away from Sinanon, not to be in the vicinity anymore. Chuck added they would get the license number of their car and they would be chased down and wish they were never born if they caused trouble again. End quote and blog post. Yeah, so they're a welcoming committee of sorts, kind of locals, almost a cruise director type, showing the lay of the land. Early February 1976, Chuck announced another edict on the wire. His latest edict was entitled Childbirth Unmasked. This was a long speech, but some key takeaways are that, well, number one, babies born into Sinanon were cutting into Chuck's profit margin. And number two, nobody loves Chuck more than Chuck loves Chuck. Over the wire, he announced, quote, "There's no profit to this community in raising our own children. Every baby that we indulge a Sinanon female with takes up a bed and somewhere between $100,000 and $200,000 worth of energy. To those who claim they wanted to have a baby," he explained, "the experience was greatly overrated. Quote, I understand it's more like crapping out a football than anything else. I think children are a very bad investment." The long rant berated an astonishing contempt for his followers. Quote, "All the dummies, you, all of you all just sit there as this organization gets richer and fatter and more fun to be in and more powerful, and you love that, but you're all alike. You sit there, mum, when I make these speeches." It revealed, too, how Dietrich saw himself. Quote, "I have done exactly like the rest of the guys that run the world. I could have run a state, a country, a city. It doesn't make any difference. I'm one of those guys. I know the magic." It wasn't long before Dietrich came up with a practical solution. All male members would receive vasectomies, and pregnant females were encouraged to have abortions. Chuck said, quote, "Having an abortion is like squeezing a boil. Nothing more." 9 women got abortions, and one, sadly, was in her last trimester. I hate you, Chuck. He even told one couple that they could keep their child if they gave him $30,000. Around 80 vasectomies took place in 1976. One former member said, quote, "There were literally endless, ongoing, intense attack sessions going on focused on males who refused to get vasectomies. As soon as they gave in, they'd walk into the next room and there were doctors waiting to give them vasectomies." Of all the men, Chuck was one of the only ones who didn't get snipped. He said, quote, "What if I want to have some more children someday?" In April 1977, Chuck's wife Betty died and he found himself alone. After a short grieving process, he immediately went on the wire and announced that he would accept applications from any woman who wanted to marry him. He said in an interview later, quote, "I sent up a flare like any monarch of old times would have done. I let the word out that I was available." He even began wearing red suspenders and called them his courting suspenders. Chuck was on the prowl. He went on the wire to announce his criteria for his ideal woman. He wanted a woman with the body of a 30-year-old, the wisdom of an 80-year-old, and the intelligence of a 45-year-old. And the face that could get a contract in Hollywood, but with enough experience to have her face totally ruined. Up to 12 women applied. The first one had a dinner date with Chuck, but after she wouldn't get into the hot tub with him, she was a no-go. The next woman slept with him immediately and moved into his home, but she was kicked out right afterwards when she called him out during a game session about his sexual performance. Then Chuck started a campaign to promote better sex among couples. Copies of the Tao of Sex were handed out. The men were encouraged to try tantric sex, and early ejaculation began to be ridiculed at games. Because Chuck had been made fun of, everyone had to pay. But he finally landed on the third gal, Ginny Shorn, a 31-year-old teacher at one of the Synanon schools. And because Chuck married a stranger, everyone else would be required to do so. So shortly thereafter, he decided that marriage should no longer be permanent. Couples were told to split up and form new 3-year-long love matches. Matches decided on by Chuck. Synanon managers would make sure that the couples were repaired with the partner that Chuck chose for them. Chuck also participated, and he broke up with his deceased wife, Betty, via a Ouija board in one session to really solidify his new marriage to Ginny. Within days, 230 couples had filed for divorce. Chuck called this switching of couples emotional surgery, and the new couples began attacking each other viciously at game sessions because, naturally, they didn't want to be with each other. Chuck upped the ante again and, well, made the couples go on drills. This meant that wherever they were, no matter what they were doing, they were to have sex on command. One man named Phil Ritter was opposed to this, and he was on the receiving end of his wife filing for divorce from him per Chuck's order. The former member Ritter reported later that, to make matters worse, Synanon was restricting how often Ritter could visit their 3-year-old daughter. He had filed a motion to be allowed to see her. In retaliation one day, as Ritter was returning home from the supermarket, two young men approached him. Without saying a word, they beat him with wooden mallets, leaving him on the ground bleeding with a fractured skull. They didn't even take his wallet. The attack was among at least 18 that the California Attorney General's office eventually linked to Synanon. Their recruitment process also became violent. In an excerpt from an article by LA Mag entitled "The Story of This Drug Rehab Turned Violent Cult Is Wild, Wild Country Caliber Bizarre," a woman named Frances Nguyen had a history of psychosis. When her husband Ed noticed that she appeared to be on the verge of another episode, he planned to take her to a treatment center later after he returned from work. So before leaving, he told her to go to the Venice Family Clinic for a tranquilizer to hold her over. The clinic, however, suggested Frances go to Synanon. She was then kidnapped by Synanon members on the pretense that she thought she was just going in for simple counseling. But within minutes of walking through the door, she found herself being shorn by someone with an electric razor. She was screamed at as part of the game, told her husband didn't want her, that only Synanon could help. The next day, Frances was shipped up by bus to a facility in Tomales Bay. This, she was told, was her new home. Her husband, Ed, had no idea. When he went to visit her, thinking she was still in Santa Monica, he was informed that he couldn't see her for 90 days. In a panic, Ed contacted attorney Paul Morantz. Morantz, who had wanted to be a writer and also now operates a popular blog I had mentioned before, exposing cults like Synanon, he wanted to be a writer, but he gained even more distinction as an attorney, suing a group of nursing homes that were kidnapping homeless alcoholics, shooting them up with Thorazine, and collecting Medicare and Medicaid for treating them. The nursing home case was all-consuming, and he planned to get back to writing, but that was until June of 1977 when he received that call from Ed Nguyen. The story tugged at Morantz. He called one of his contacts at the Department of Public Health and asked what Synanon was licensed for. The voice on the other end of the phone dropped to a whisper. "Synanon is not licensed," he said. "How can it not be licensed?" asked Morantz. "We don't understand it either," the health official said. "And they don't let us in." Back in the 1960s, when Synanon was charged with running a hospital without a license, Governor Pat Brown signed a law clarifying that Dietrich's brand of drug treatment wasn't medical care per se, but it did need a license. But the bill didn't specify anything about treating mental illness, which meant Synanon could be in trouble for taking Frances. So Morantz pressured Sinanon to release her. When he and Ed Wynn went to pick her up, they saw a sea of people with shaved heads and overalls, smiling. It gave Morantz goosebumps. Something was seriously wrong. Quote, I had a sense, Morantz recalls today, that everything in the 31 years of my life that had happened previously was all pointed towards this moment in this time, that this was going to be the test that I think I always wanted to have. Morantz effectively declared war on Sinanon that day, and Sinanon responded. Boy, they responded. Rumor had it that Chuck could be heard over Sinanon's private radio network ranting, who is this guy Morantz? Why doesn't someone break his legs? In a recorded speech later seized by the LAPD, Dietrich fumed, we are not going to mess with the old-time turn-the-other-cheek religious posture. We're going to, our religious posture is, don't mess with us. You can get killed, dead, physically dead. We either have a good thing here or we don't. If we had a good thing here, then we are not going to permit people like greedy lawyers to destroy it. Paul Morantz was one of the few who tried to warn the world about Sinanon, and it would come back to bite him, literally. After suing Sinanon on behalf of Frances and Edwin, who claimed that Frances had been kidnapped, brainwashed, and tortured by the group for purposes of financial gain despite her emotional instability, they were awarded $300,000. Morantz worked obsessively to get other members out too, lobbying the Marin County supervisors and the State Department of Public Health to crack down on Sinanon. He was scared, though, because he knew that Chuck was capable of violence. Threatening phone calls were coming at all hours of the night towards Paul, but what really concerned him was when the threats stopped. Paul bought a shotgun. Constant looking over his shoulder, he'd check under his car for bombs before getting in. He was exhausted. So, as Morantz returned to his small home in Pacific Palisades the evening of October 11, 1977, he was eager to turn on the TV and relax over Game 1 of the World Series, the Dodgers versus the Yankees. He said, quote, for one moment, I'm not going to think about Sinanon. I'm just going to watch the baseball game. And as Paul Morantz placed his notebooks on the kitchen table and then walked to his mail slot that was built into his front door, he pulled his hand out with a deadly rattlesnake attached, rattle removed so he wouldn't suspect it in the box. He said, quote, I actually saw the head strike out and bite me. As it happened, my left hand swung into the air and the snake went into the air and then landed on the floor. He quickly shut the door in shock inside his house and kept the snake in so the snake wouldn't attack his dogs. He then ran out the back door and screamed to his neighbor, call the police, call an ambulance, I've been bitten by a rattlesnake, it's Sinanon, Sinanon got me. Word of the attack quickly went national. News anchor Walter Cronkite called it, quote, bizarre, even by cult standards. The 4.5-foot-long diamondback was killed by emergency services upon arriving on the scene, and Paul was rushed to the hospital. Paul spent 6 days in the hospital. His neighbors had been on high alert, though, before this happened, because Paul had told them to keep an eye out for Sinanon members in the neighborhood. You know, stalking his house or the whole neighborhood. One neighbor had written down the license plate of a suspicious vehicle seen the day of the attack. And when they ran the plates, it was found to be registered to Sinanon. Today, Paul Morantz, who now has a lifelong blood disease, which he believes may be related to the snake bite, told LA Mag, quote, I'm going to set the record for the longest murder ever. Following this, two members of the Imperial Marines were accused of conspiracy to commit murder on Paul Morantz. This incident and another where an NBC helicopter tried to get aerial shots of the compound for a story they were working on were shot at from the ground from automatic weapons while they flew above. This stuff started to get people's attention. The story they were working on never ran on the nightly news. However, thanks to the work of Morantz and that of a tiny local newspaper, the Point Reyes Light, the wider world started to take notice. It was not an easy task, though. When Time magazine and NBC ran critical profiles on Synanon, their executives were bombarded with death threats. A former board director of the group who spoke out against Chuck found his guard dog hanged outside his house. Another former member who wanted to visit one of the Synanon complexes was tied to a post and pistol-whipped for being a split E. Tension was building. It seemed an explosion of extreme violence could happen at any time, and the media wouldn't stop reporting on it now. Chuck attempted to win over the media, but instead came off super arrogant and even threatened to club a reporter with a cane in front of two police officers. After that, Chuck had then fled to Europe. He took his lawyer and his wife to southern Italy, and then a dozen of Chuck's closest advisors flew out to join them. It was supposed to be a restful vacation, but instead it turned into a drunken orgy. Chuck had fallen off the wagon. That is, if he hadn't already been off for the last several decades. They switched partners almost daily, and word got back to Synanon that Chuck was drinking again, and Chuck was forced to give as much of an apology as he was capable of, and all was forgiven. He returned back. And then, on November 17th, 1978, over 900 people were killed and an American congressman assassinated in what became known as the Jonestown Massacre in Guyana. Suddenly, the authorities could no longer look the other way at what, in the cold light of day, was undoubtedly a cult. Within days, Synanon was raided by the police. Incriminating material was found, including a recording of Diedrich's new religious posture. Chuck himself, though, was nowhere to be found. They eventually tracked him down on his Lake Havasu property. At the time of his arrest, Chuck was so drunk that they had to take him out on a stretcher. He was charged with conspiracy to commit murder, and Synanon was facing multiple million-dollar lawsuits from people they had attacked. Chuck eventually got a plea deal and didn't have to face prison time as he was already so sick and possibly dying at the time. Part of Chuck's probation was that he had to cut ties with Synanon. Synanon also lost its tax-exempt status, and many higher-ups were charged with various crimes and conspiracies. Chuck died in 1997, and he was still living with his cult dating game arranged bride, Ginny. He never faced jail time, though, as he got to live as a free man for over a decade after his judgment. Synanon still operates today in two factions in Berlin, Germany, but its lasting effect on the rehab and troubled teen industry echoes and rules today. This part is a tad out of order, but it will lead into next week's episode. During Synanon's time at the Marin County compound, they developed something called the Punk Squad. Juveniles in the 70s were often sent to Synanon by agencies or courts and juvenile officers on recommendation, but little did they know that these kids were now in a militaristic and abusive group under Synanon's control. These kids understandably did not want to be there, and many tried to escape. Nearby farmers would house them for a day and feed them and buy them a bus ticket away from Synanon. Now, today there are many anonymous blog posts and posts on the cult education website from former teens who were unwittingly forced into beatings and labor by Synanon for minor infractions they made on the outside, like they didn't need to be there. An unruly teen at school, a kid caught smoking dope, a perceived promiscuous teen were thrown to the wolves at Synanon, and their lives were never the same. On these blogs, there are recollections of teens being stripped naked and beaten in front of other residents for discretions that included attempts at suicide or escape, teenage girls and boys being punched in the face and stomach by adult men, games lasting 36 to 72 hours without food or sleep, and former teenage members whose lives were forever changed by the abuse they endured at Synanon. These kids and the kids that will follow in their footsteps are the ghosts of Synanon and the abuse programs that would be inspired by the Synanon cult. They carry this abuse and trauma for the rest of their lives. Some escaped, and some are still missing. And some have died mysteriously at the hands of these organizations. We will cover their stories and more in the following episodes. This concludes this episode of Seven Deadly Sinners on the cult of Synanon that went on to influence a billion-dollar rehab and troubled teen industry that we are going to explore, like I said, over the next few episodes. It's truly crazy that these still exist today, and we can partially thank Chuck Dietrich for inspiring unqualified programs, including religious-based reforms, to pop up all over the country and severely damage our nation's youth. Thank you guys so much for listening, and if you're enjoying the show, the best thing you can do is to tell a friend, leave a 5-star rating, and positive review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps more than you know. Thank you. Seven Deadly Sinners was written and created by me, Rachel O'Brien. Research and writing assistance by Kate Codman. Sound engineering and music production by Greg Hunter. And produced by Rachel O'Brien and Greg Hunter. Thank you for listening.